You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiya. The Cambridge Center for Adult Education recently held a conversation about progressive architecture. The evening featured Nader Tehrani, a co-founder and principal of the architecture and design firm Office Da. He was interviewed by the architect and architecture critic Robert Campbell.
Thank you. I don't know whether we'll be talking about progressive architecture or regressive architecture. I'll leave that up to you. We're going to talk about the world as we see it right now. The way we decided to organize things, Nader has brought some slides, as you can see on the screen, and he's going to run through those, using them to raise a set of issues about architecture. We're not going to talk about them. They're just to sort of get everybody thinking about some of the issues, and then we'll have a discussion between ourselves and with your help, I think, afterwards.
Good evening. It's a great honor to be here. And we're in a particular moment, as you all know, and it seems that the bottom line is going to determine a lot of things. The slides are not organized in any order, but there's a kind of micro-narrative that is involved in it. With the current state of the economy, a good deal of the architectural projects as we know them have come to a halt. And so it has also, because of the crisis and certain urgency, brought to question about what is it that we do, what is it about what we have done and continue to do that is relevant, and how do we take this moment of crisis to rethink the situation. Obviously, there are great crises all around the world. This is not an American predicament, but even those lands, this is Dubai, that are built on false loans.
Slide over a little bit, so I think we're blocking.
Oh,
people.
I'm sorry.
Do what we can here. Is that better?
Water container.
My water container. Okay.
A great deal of the
this building, by the way, was going to be twice the height of the Empire State Building, and in the current economic recession, the term that we're all being schooled to use, they stopped building it, but it's already the tallest building in the world. They just stopped at some point. They were going to go up further.
And Dubai, of course, has been the site of a great deal of architectural speculation. All of them are projected to be real projects, some of them silly, some of them spectacular, all of them overpriced. But it's still open to question which ones of them were productive experiments, and we should test that.
I'd like to add a line to that, too. Dubai, the 3% of the gross national product in Dubai is from oil, 3%, that's all. It is a real estate... what would you call it? A game. It's a Ponzi scheme.
Ponzi
it's a real estate
yes.
Ponzi scheme. Where as long as you keep feeding in more tourists and more jet setters at the bottom, you know, you can keep on building these things at the top. Once that stops, the whole thing collapses, which appears to be happening. Question then is why it occurred in the first place.
Now the idea that architecture could be called on to resuscitate a different form of crisis is not a new thing. And the case of Bilbao was a controversial one in the 90s, in the sense that with the kind of decline of economy, or at least the shipping industry in Bilbao, the idea of a new cultural center, a museum, the Guggenheim Museum, became the mechanism for them not only to revive urbanistically the riverfront, but also the very industry that helped to construct the building. So the idea that an avant-garde piece of architecture, the idea that a great piece of speculation could become a generator of a good deal of economy was at stake here. But then, of course, as this happened, every city in the world wanted its own Bilbao building.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this context also, China has made its own contributions. The McAllen building that we built in South Boston was composed of a steel structure at the very moment that steel was much, much more economic than concrete. But with the rise of China and the rate at which they were buying steel, by the end of the construction, it had become more expensive. But at the same time, even China is contributing to a great deal of innovation because of its density, producing architectural types for which there are no precedents. So in many ways, it's contributing to the knowledge about the city and testing out new ideas, certain things that we cannot do here in America. Mm-hmm. And certainly this kind of speculation is happening in more than one place. I think this one is in Denmark or in Holland. I don't remember right now. But within this context, some of the more basic and fundamental questions are being brought to the forefront. This is the Genzyme building in our own Boston, and is one of the award winners of the Harleston Parker Award for a noted and most beautiful building. It's given once every 2 years or three
every
years?
Every year.
Every year?
Mm-hmm.
And the question of sustainability for which this building is noted, among other things, is really what's at stake in this architecture. And the question is it the architecture that's sustainable? Is it integrated? Or is its functions of sustainability just a kind of accessory to it? In the middle of all of this is an architecture that is completely different than what you and I recognize to be the world around us. And in part, this has to do with the advances made in computation and digital fabrication. Certainly, this may not have come to Main Street mainstream fabrication, but as Bilbao has demonstrated, or as Bilbao has paved the road, the idea that modernism produced mass production, now mass customization can be built with the same economy. So things like this, which look extraordinary, may actually be quite common or feasible in the coming future. And so you've seen those kinds of things built by Zaha Hadid, which are becoming part of a more common economy. And as a last theme is the question of infrastructure. With the new stimulus package, with all of the new initiatives of how to reinvest in the city, in its urbanism, part of that money in part is going to go to mend and fix all of the infrastructure of the United States. But what does that really mean? What is its infrastructure? Yes, high schools are part of that. Yes, highway systems, bridges are part of that. But what about social infrastructure? What about social sustainability? These projects, this one in Seattle, in a way takes on the issue of infrastructure not as in its most crude form as circulation or highway, but rather the notion of infrastructure as public space, as parkways, and as amenities for public life. Here you're looking at help me out, Robert.
The High Line.
The High Line in New York City, an obsolete piece of infrastructure, which is now being redesigned and fabricated by a team including James Corner and Diller Scofidio. And finally, an extraordinary piece of infrastructure built in Yokohama, a kind of pièce de résistance, a huge piece of infrastructure that is a pier for the public, but also the boat liner station on the port of Yokohama.
I guess I was the one who suggested this. I find it... Well, in fact, one of the next ones, don't show it yet, is Peabody Terrace, which is a housing project at Harvard. And I was an associate partner in the firm that did Peabody Terrace, although I had nothing to do with it, Sir Jackson and Associates. And the first article I ever wrote for the Boston Globe, and I won't tell you how long ago that was, I had gone to a party in Cambridge, and I had overheard in the neighborhood of Peabody Terrace And I overheard a typically bright Harvard graduate say, oh, it's such a nice little neighborhood we have here, except for those three horrible towers that Harvard has built right over there. And I thought, then, architects love Peabody Terrace. They did then and they still do. I do. Most people hate it. And so I thought from the very beginning, can't I try to bring the subculture of architecture with its rather specialized tastes and the larger culture around us more together? Having failed at that for 30-some years now, I'm still working on it. And in fact, I have a theory about City Hall and Peabody Terrace that's very simple. People hate concrete. And it's an associational thing. We associate concrete with civic engineering, with highway ramps and tunnels and foundations and things of that kind. And so it comes to feel like an inferior material, which it needn't be at all. But that's another set of issues. But let's all hope we save City Hall. And I'm sure you all agree with me. And that we encourage this or a future mayor to give it the kind of love and attention and renovation that it very badly needs. It could be a wonderful building. It is certainly not in its present condition. There's Peabody Terrace. And the Holyoke Center, and same architect.
The Holyoke Center is also important because there's a great part of the legacy of modernism and a fallacy that thinks of modernism as buildings not interested in urbanism or disengage objects in the landscape. And this is one of those buildings that is very much invested in framing the space of Harvard Square, engaging the street, animating the street, and in fact even incorporating infrastructure as the bridges go down underneath it and mm-hmm. pop up the other side. So it's a mm-hmm. very sophisticated and robust building, even though it's in concrete.
Okay. We'll go to a more of an interview phase now, although I'm sure I won't be able to shut up into the role of questioner very much. But based on these themes that you have raised already, I think everyone feels that a page is turning right now in the history of architecture, the history of urbanism, the way we build cities, the way we build neighborhoods, the way we develop transportation. Do we stay with the automobile? Do we do something else? I wonder if you could just sort of summarize from your point of view as a practitioner and a professor, where are we right now? Where have we come from and where are we going?
Well, one of the dangers of moments like this is to sell all your stocks. Mm-hmm. So in architecture, that's the same case. Do we abandon all of those disciplinary things that make the peculiarities of architectural knowledge mm-hmm. advance in a certain way? Mm-hmm. And my caution would be that this is not what we want to do, because though there may have been some reckless behavior, let's say, in the Dubais, mm-hmm. and yet there were some important advances that were made along the way. So part of moments like this probably has to do with introspection, looking back on our techniques. How do we build? How do we integrate? How do we look at the ways in which we draw things? Geometry is still the basis for the advancement of certain things. They don't impact every citizen in the room in a direct way as a vote in the booth, but in fact the way in which they contribute to the knowledge of architecture is important. Mm-hmm. So the first precaution is really to say that architecture is an art, and it doesn't advance culture in a direct way, but in a mediated mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. So this is a moment to precisely not abandon that research, but to intensify it.
Are you implying that there has been, in the previous 10, 20, 30 years, too much attention to the formal qualities of architecture, to the kind of excitingness of architecture?
There is no doubt that certainly in the last 10 years, a great and even maybe excessive attention.
I know you're saying we don't want to just back off that completely, but right. You did show Bilbao, and Bilbao, if you, those of you who may not have recognized that was the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao by Frank Gehry, the California architect who is the world's probably most famous architect at the moment. And when that was so successful that that a building became a tourist attraction, and that has not been true of contemporary buildings very often. Millions of people were coming to Bilbao to see the building, which did not have an art collection of its own, although it was an art museum. And suddenly the whole world seemed to want to build another Bilbao, and that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
The story actually behind this building is that Gehry was commissioned initially to build the Disney Hall in Los Angeles. Through a series of experiments and through a series of processes and budget cuts, he was unable to build that. And when Bilbao commissioned him to do this museum, all of the exploration, all of the test runs were done in this museum, and then subsequently, 5-10 years later, were built in Disney. So in a way, this, stole the mantle of the Disney and was built first.
It's fascinating to me, though, that suddenly every city in the world wanted to have its own Bilbao, in very much the way that Western European cities in the Middle Ages wanted to have their own cathedral. There has been a similar kind of, we're not a real city unless we have a.
But the result of this is also maybe an unfortunate or maybe an arguable, in a way, centeredness on the icon. In other words, architecture was reduced to an image. Architecture became no more than a postcard. And of course, it's not expected of a general audience or a general public to relish in the technological advancements, in the formal advancements, in the material advancements of a project like this. But in fact, it is precisely this project, among others, that paved the way for a new generation of thinking. And it paved the way for an architecture that does not necessarily look like this. So it's not icon specific.
Let's move along those same lines to another subject. You talked about Dubai and the kind of excessive, maybe, architecture that was being built there. Let me just throw out another question. Who's it being built for? And what are the social and political responsibilities of architects?
Well, I really don't know who this was built for, because apparently people were turning around their investments before the things were actually built. So the Ponzi scheme to which you referred suggests a social vacuum with a kind of projected public that never existed and may never exist. So maybe it was built on the principle of build and they shall come, which is not the way in which Hong Kong evolved incrementally and systematically over time. But really, in a way, this was trying to build overnight the notion of a free port, but essentially rooted in its real estate first. And the idea of a kind of free state where you can do whatever you want to do that you can't do presumably in Saudi Arabia and Iran. So,
interesting. There's another set of issues. I don't want to move too quickly through too many issues, so you can stop me if you want. But there's the whole issue of settlement patterns. There's been a lot of criticism of the very spread out, thinned out kind of suburban and exurban development, and its very high cost in energy, and maybe its cost in social relations, the difficulty in developing communities in that kind of world. That's a responsibility of architects, too, to think about settlement patterns and what's appropriate.
I mean, that probably, and I'm sorry, I don't have slides of that, but I think maybe that is the central question of today, and it has a planning dimension to it. You can make as many green buildings as you want to, but as long as your planning principles, and by the way, this is further corroborated by the architectural licensing exam, which bases the majority of its questions on suburban patterns.
That's very interesting.
And parking lots. If you do not commit to the densification of the city, the alternative of walking the city, of public transportation, how is it that you want to change the foundations on which questions of sustainability may be raised? So in many ways, the good news is that the suburbs as we knew them in the 50s also no longer exist. In a way, even the suburbs are becoming dense. So a new kind of city is emerging around Route 128. But that is not paralleled by an investment in public infrastructure, in public transportation. So there's a huge discrepancy between the reality that we live in, than the reality that the Europeans live in, for instance.
I'm a little shocked at the current bailouts by the government, which are going to quote-unquote shovel-ready projects, which always seem to be highways and bridges and tunnels for automobiles, when it seems to me, and I don't know whether you agree, we should be financing a great national rail system like every other major country in the way that we did the Interstate Highway Program two generations ago.
In part, I showed the last images as a kind of witness to that possibility. The notion that whether it's obsolete infrastructure or new infrastructure, the idea that places like commuter stations, like railway systems, like parkways, are all enmeshed in a larger project and a larger investment in the city. And certainly, yes, distances are farther here in the U.S., but that doesn't mean we cannot invest in a more robust set of connections between.
They're farther
regions.
If you think New York to Seattle, but if you think East Coast, if you think West Coast, if you think Chicago Midlands,
absolutely,
you have comparable densities to other countries, Spain, for example, that do have high-speed rail systems.
Absolutely, yes.
You mentioned when you talked about these projects, something that comes up all the time in every field I look at now. If you go to MIT, for example, not your part of MIT, there used to be all these disciplines. I'm a chemist, he's a biologist, that's medicine, that's physics. All gone, meaningless terms now. I think they were reified by the Nobel Prizes that are now hopelessly out of date, because all the interesting work is being done on the margins between two of these disciplines or more. And you're talking about landscape architecture, city planning, and architecture as all being one thing. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, from an educational point of view, what our generation inherited was a very clear narrative about disciplines. She's an architect, you know, he's an urban designer. Mm-hmm. And more recently, all of these have become blurred. Projects like this mm-hmm. are suggestive of a different kind of discipline. Is this a piece of landscape or is this a building? Mm-hmm. James Corner's notion of landscape urbanism talks not only about the artifact in question, but actually the process in which it's going to be built, the sequencing, and also the fact that nature is not about something that you deliver in the way that a building is delivered. Mm-hmm. That trees grow, there are seasons, they mature, they die. And so there's a kind of emphasis on process and the evolution of a city as, mm-hmm. as part of its design. Mm-hmm. So all of these things are being tested in a variety of ways. On top of that, you have projects like this.
What is that, by the way?
Yeah.
This is just an installation at the Museum of Modern Art for the prefabrication show. But really, it's showing the phase between prefabrication and mass customization. Mm-hmm. But really, it's showing also how the techniques of industrial design have now morphed into that of architecture. Mm-hmm. So notions of landscape, urbanism, architecture, interior design, industrial design, product design, mm-hmm. If not beyond that, yeah. questions of economics, real estate, and other kind of engineerings, right. civil, mechanical, are now being integrated in most strategic ways.
I think that's very true. When I was in architecture school, you studied architecture, and that was it, pretty much. All the students that I talk to now are interested in what you're talking about, the invention of new materials, new industrial technologies, all kinds of ideas about how cities ought to be made and put together and how people ought to live in cities. Let's talk about cities. Let's talk about Boston. Is Mayor Menino building too many tall buildings in Boston? Ha. Huh. This is being recorded.
Yeah. Which tall buildings? Which one are you talking about?
In many cities today, well, by today I mean yesterday, because all development has come to a complete halt now, yeah. as you all know, because of the economy. But say, take New York, for example, which is by and large has a good mayor and is a well-governed city. But there was a tendency, in order to get some kind of supposed public benefit, they would allow developers to make buildings higher and higher and higher. Take another 20 stories, build me some subsidized housing somewhere else. Take another 20 stories, build me a school somewhere else. That's partly because the governments are broke, because we have very low taxation in this country compared to our comparable countries. So the cities feel that the only way they can get public benefits is by dealing in real estate. Do you think there's a way out of that, or do you think it's okay?
Well, you know, it's like signing a pact with the devil at the end of the day, mm-hmm. because it is arguable that the question is not about height. Mm-hmm. In other words, the sin is not the height. A tall building may be just fine. The question really is what's at stake is to what degree is this culture, whether it's instituted by the government or by the private sector, invested mm-hmm. in a notion of the public? Mm-hmm. And how is that public redefined?
Right.
And if you get into this process of deregulation, mm-hmm. deregulation in terms of urbanism, in the mm-hmm. same way that the economy was deregulated, mm-hmm. and if you privatize everything, essentially what you're doing is you're abandoning the very public for which the infrastructure, the streets, the plazas, the parks, would have been made in a different era. Think of the Emerald Necklace, which was really an investment not for, you know, 5 years, an mm-hmm. investment that, you know, spans into the hundreds of years, and we get to enjoy it today. What kind of project can you think of today that is operating on that scale?
And the Emerald Necklace began as an infrastructural improvement, a drainage plan for the fans. So it's a very good point for your point, too. When you said privatization, I should explain, I think I understand it, but more and more city governments are asking private developers to create public space because they don't feel they have the money or the clout to create public space. And so you get space that masquerades as being public but is in fact owned by, or to a large extent owned by, private enterprise. And that's another issue.
So, for instance, when you go to South Station uh-huh. with all of the new head houses and the plazas around there, it's attempting to make all of the various plazas and spaces cohere. But actually, the various public spaces are owned by the different constituencies. So the Federal Reserve mm-hmm. has its space, South Station has its sidewalk, and mm-hmm. various other entities. Mm-hmm. And technically, that means they can kick you off the site. In the same way, the premises of a mall are private spaces, essentially. They're open from 9 in the morning till 9 at night. And
don't give a lecture on the virtues of communism in an American shopping mall. It's not public space.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, but also not anybody is allowed to walk in. Mm-hmm. They have the right to refuse.
I think we're seeing more and more of this, and maybe we're talking too much about it. But an example that I recently read about in a book that's coming out soon by Michael Sorkin, who is one of the best writers on architecture who ever lived, but he lives near Washington Square. And he says Washington Square is constantly being closed off to the public by some filming company that is filming commercials or movies, or and stars are running around and going into their trailers where they have ideal conditions, but the public isn't allowed in. That's another example of the privatization of what was once completely public space.
But a major form of revenue raising.
It's all about revenue. So government is all about making money, right?
If you like, I can go back to this.
I think the denomination is too small.
Yeah.
What else you want to talk about? What architects do you particularly admire? Let's say not Michelangelo, but the ones that your father or grandfather or grandmother generation that have made a difference to you, and why?
Well, the truth is, they're not very common architects, like people like Eladio Dieste, mm-hmm. the Uruguayan architect, mm-hmm. Is not one of the modern masters the way you would think of Frank Lloyd Wright, Mies van der Rohe, or Le Corbusier. He was a curious figure who could not be easily defined as an architect or an engineer, mm-hmm. but essentially he was an inventor, and he came up with ways of vaulting with thin shell structures made mm-hmm. of ceramics post-tensioned.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
And
there was an exhibition at MIT last year.
Right, exactly. And he did extraordinary experiments and forms generated out of a kind of study that cannot be reducible to that of one discipline. Mm-hmm. You can think of Gaudí as having done similar things, which is maybe a more popular name out there.
Gaudí, the Barcelona architect, turn of the century, who did the Sagrada Familia Cathedral.
So while Gaudí maybe is more spectacular in his association with a form of surrealism and mm-hmm. Extraordinary forms, Dieste was more intricate in his and mm-hmm. subtle in the way that his buildings okay. operated, both as part of the city, but also as spectacular.
I'm just trying to get it. That's interesting. And what is your background? Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up a little bit.
Now that you mentioned Uruguay, yeah. We should probably locate you somewhere.
First of all, I'm Iranian. But I was born in England with a splattering of places I grew up between Switzerland, Pakistan, South Africa, and Iran. And eventually I came to high school here right before the revolution, and that's in 1978, and have been here for the majority of that time with one stint in Italy and another one in London. So basically mm-hmm. I've been here since then. But effectively, I suppose you would call me Iranian-American.
Well, call you a globalist, and that's true of so the whole generation of younger architects now in Cambridge and Boston. They seem to be from all over the place, and they seem to travel all over the place. Ginny Park, who is one such person, I was just writing something about her. She was born in
She's right there.
Is Ginny there?
Please
hello.
Stand up.
Wave your hand. Hi, Ginny. Ginny was just named one of the 8 outstanding young architects in the country by the American Institute of Architects.
All right.
Her partner, John Hong, is there with her, who deserves some of that credit, too. But Ginny studied industrial design. I should ask you this, but I'll say it anyway. Just correct me if I'm wrong, in Japan. Then architecture at the Graduate School of Design has taught or practiced in Madrid, Houston, Boston, Korea. Where else? You're opening a branch office in Seoul, another one in New York. I mean, it's what the Times writes about as the kind of horizontality, the flattening of the earth. I think that we're seeing very much in the. I guess I got that right. I left out something, I know. Where did I leave out that you've either taught or worked?
Mongolia.
Oh, the project in Mongolia, of course, yeah. That's another example of the kind of globalization. Some developer out of his mind in Mongolia decided he would build 100 houses and hire 100 different architects to design them. From all over the world, mostly I think United States and Europe. And Ginny and John are doing a house there that I wish I had a slide of, because it's not like any other house you ever saw. It looks like an upside down tooth. Is that accurate? Okay. I want to get back though to the issue of influences a little bit. Certain things were very important to me. Jane Jacobs, let's say, was very important to me. Le Corbusier, because he dominated the School of Design when I was there, not for his right. city planning, which was terrible, but for his architecture, which can be wonderful. But are there others besides the one you've mentioned that you think are important, not only to you, but to your sort of generation, your sort of segment?
I'm only going to name the unpopular ones, because I'm going to shock you by my references. But people like Plechnik, which I know was mm-hmm. Kind of heralded as the father of postmodernism, even though I don't mm-hmm. think so, is one of those extraordinary architects.
This is a Czechoslovakian architect.
Maybe some of the more well-known Scandinavians, from Aalto, who has done the Baker Dormitory here in town, but also Leverance mm-hmm. and Asplund, are very interesting protagonists because of the, they all kind of handled a very delicate moment in architectural history, transitioning from the Beaux-Arts or the era of classicism to modernism. And the way they navigated that was in very intelligent ways. And Le Corbusier certainly was part of that same generation. Mm-hmm. But in many ways, the way in which they handled cultural problems demonstrated that the investment in their research and in their work was not about iconography and the image of architecture alone, but the larger urbanistic role it played, the larger way in which it defined its relationship to the landscape, material questions, and the way they communicated. The way that classicism communicated in one era was rendered obsolete in some ways with modernism, but they found ways in which to substitute that language with other ways of communication, which did not abandon craft, which did not abandon tactility, which did not abandon color, if you like. And so there was a range of ways in which their architectures operated, which in many ways the historians of modern architecture forgot to talk about. Yeah.
That's very interesting. I think that's very, very true. I think Alvar Aalto is becoming more and more influential as time goes on, partly because, well, let's not get into that one architect, but I think someone interested in materiality, interested in tradition, interested in urbanism, interested in the garden, interested in a whole lot of things that got left out of some contemporary architecture. I don't know if it's, we've been shooting for 40 minutes. Do we want to maybe go and extend the conversation?
Maybe open the conversation out, no?
Yeah.
You've been listening to the architects Nader Tehrani and Robert Campbell on ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia. Thanks for joining us.